Welcome to Listening to Paint Dry, a podcast about the art and hobby of miniature painting. I'm Mike.
And I'm Deb. Thank you for joining us on our continued journey to become better, braver, happier painters. Today, we are joined by the one and only Francesco Farabi of America.
Francesco.
Good morning or good evening or whatever it is.
Oh man, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast, Francesco. We, you know, getting to meet you last year at Adepticon and take your class was absolutely amazing. I'm still processing. That's
very cool. I'm very happy that you love that.
You know, and I apologize, Deb. I want to get this because I'm totally going to forget this later. But you showed a trick where you took the 3 primary colors and you put 2 in your hands and the other one is, you know, the complement. I'm working with a couple of people that have color issues and they were having a hard time with color theory and such. And I showed them, this is from an amazing teacher from Italy. I took a class last year and show them. And I'm still getting pinged that's such an amazing trick, you know, switch hand. I was just like, that is so brilliant. So
you shared with the world the fact that I ate the coral wheel.
Well, I tell them.
Everyone knows that now. I have issues with the coral wheel.
There were so many things at the beginning of that class because I take a lot of notes. And there are so many things at the beginning of the class, the notes that I actually typed them up and I actually have them printed out on my painting desk. Like just some of the tidbits of the information, you know. My favorite thing was the whole, who the hell is blue at night? Nobody's blue at night.
I made these kind of classes for a lot of years. So some of the funny things are, I don't know what to say, are trained for years, so I know that works.
I'm sorry, Dev, I didn't mean to step in there. I apologize.
It's all good. I am looking forward to taking the exact same class this coming year at Adepticon with you. So Mike's got me very excited for this one.
Dev, bring a caramel macchiato with you.
I can't wait for the caramel macchiato.
There we go. All right. Lesson learned. I feel like you should be offended by the use of macchiato in Starbucks beverages, though.
I love it. I discovered that I am a super fan of caramel macchiato. Really.
Okay.
It's so different from Italian coffee. So.
Right. I mean, that's the thing is, like, I'd rather have an Italian macchiato than a Starbucks macchiato. But I like the really rich, bitter coffees. So.
Yeah, me too. But, you know. It's something different. When I am in the US, I want to feel...
Drink like an American, yeah.
Yeah, that's the point.
Embrace the high fructose corn syrup, my friend. So, Francesco, what got you into miniature painting in the first place?
Okay, you are asking this to a man of 44 years old, and I started to paint, I think, the first time at 12 or something like that. So it's a very hard question. I try to be quick, but I think that basically I had miniature in my life from always, forever. I mean, the first time I had miniatures was when I was a kid, around 10 years old, something like that. My mom bought for me a Grenadier, I think, box of figure. That was something taken from Dungeons and Dragons, something like that. And since my mama was good at decoupage and bricolage, little things, she started to paint this for me. And then I started to paint them alone. That was my first contact. Then the second and the most important one was in the 94, 95, when I was 15 years old, something like that, because close to my school, it was open a little store that was called Il Principe Nero, the Black Prince. And this was a little store of miniature painting. There were two guys that painting figure, and they sell painted figure from Games Workshop, Grenadier, Ralph Parta, all this kind of stuff. And for me, it was very funny. I discovered that because my best friend makes for me as a present one of these little knights. I think I still have these knights so somewhere in my house. And I was completely shocked about the quality that seems for me incredible. So I wanted to know them, and I became the close friends to them. And every morning, I take the bus before to go to school to stay an half an hour, 40 minutes with them, because they started to paint like really early in the morning, and they stay into the office, into the studio. And I stay with them into the studio to try to learn how to paint. And I painted for them a little bit during these years. Then I stopped when around 18, something like that. I stopped because, you know, 18 years old, you want something different. You don't want to paint figure. You feel like you have to grow. Then you discover that it's better to become kids than grow. But okay, at that time it was like this. And I restarted in real in 2003, 2004, with my girlfriend of the time that now is my wife. And I entered in the local store in my town that was the store of miniature of my town. And it was the first time I coming back there after a lot of years. And it was like, oh, I want to see it again. Let me see what's happened. And I bought one box of Orc from Warhammer Fantasy. And then everything start again, basically, because at that point I start to paint again. I always wanted to, one of my dream when I was a kid and young, it's to become an illustrator. I usually draw a lot, paint a lot, much more try to draw, okay? I have a lot of book of my drawing of that times. And I suppose that I wanted to be like an animator, an illustrator, or, you know, comic book drawer, something like that. But then, you know, life changed things. And at some point I discovered that I was not a very good drawer, but painting miniature was something that seems works for me. I mean, it was my cup of tea. That's the point. So for that reason, I started in a serious way. Then I discovered that in my town, there were groups of people that were in Golden Demon, that goes into different kind of event like this. In 2004, I went into my first Golden Demon, and this is basically, I consider this the beginning of my career. It was the first international competition, my first important hours, and from that point, it's the beginning of my life as a painter.
Amazing, amazing.
I speak a lot.
No, I mean, honestly, like, to have been able to hit Golden Demons back in 2004, I think I'd have loved to actually have been participating at that level back then. I, like you, started painting when I was very, very young, back in the early 90s. But I didn't actually really go in for competitions until a lot, lot later, kind of 10, 15 years after you. And I do regret that, because I think it was a bit more of an open space, especially the Golden Demon contest back then.
Yes, Golden Demon was very different at that time. I mean, some of the things of Golden Demon were still there. I mean, it was always a competition guided by a company that has a lot of interests that are different from art, but it was different. It was different. I think during the year between 2003 and 2010 or 12, something like that. I mean, for a decade, I think that Golden Demon was the place where the fantasy miniature painting grows. And in some way, Golden Demons, during these 10 years, in Italy, in Spain, in Germany, in England, in Poland, and also in US, allow a lot the possibility to the painters to be a little bit free. I mean, not completely, but a little bit, with sculpted figure, with collaboration, with new ideas, with things. Okay, at some point, not always you can win with something very strange, weird, or different. But for 10 years, a lot of different style grows in Golden Demon. Yeah. And I think now it's not like this. It's changed completely.
Yeah, and although they weren't allowed, I think the Rackham aesthetic really influenced a lot of the entries time, right? Like, it was a real shift away from the Games Workshop required style, which we don't have now, right? Like, it's, you know, we've seen entries win purely for being excellently executed heavy metal pieces, right?
Well, but now we have, now it's different because we have a lot of opportunity to be free in a lot of different competition. Talked about a time where in the normal competitions, like historical competitions, fantasy were like a little table and no one take a look at that. So now we have Monte San Savino, we have Scale Model Challenge. In the last World Model Expo, fantasy and historical were quite an half and an half. Not an half and an half, but quite. So times changing a lot in the last 20 years. But if I remember that times where there were nothing for us, I mean, for a fantasy painter, the only competition that gives you the idea to win an Oscar was the Golden Demon. Now we have a lot of different things that allows you to choose. I mean, if you want to compete into the Golden Demon, you know the rules, you know what is the point, you go there. It's not anymore, for example, my cup of tea because I'm not interested to paint with this kind of style that was something that I did 20 years ago, 15 years ago. I had my period of Golden Demon. I won my Slayer's World, so I am happy. And for me, it's enough. I mean, it's okay that the young goes there. But it's now it's like just a little part of the way of painting. And probably also the more, the less free. I mean, the more dedicated to something very specific.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think the prestige of other competitions for a lot of people is not quite up there. You know, I think if you're a serious painter, you'd rather do well at Monte than at Golden Demon. But I think for a lot of the people that we teach and that we interact with, and maybe even for a lot of the listeners of this show, Golden Demon still holds that super massive prestige that I struggle with because I'm not entirely sure it still deserves it in a way.
Well, but I think it's also normal. I mean, it's not something we can really fight against. I mean, Golden Demon, it's an emanation of GW. GW, it's our mother. I mean, also for me, I started with GW. Sometimes people that listen to me talking about Golden Demon thinks that I ate GW. But it's not like this. I competed in the Golden Demon for 10 years. I won 2 Slayer's World, a lot of golds. I mean, I competed in the Golden Demon for a lot of time. And I still love Warhammer figures. So I have nothing against the art direction, the world that is Games Workshop. But at the same time, we also have to know that Games Workshop is an incredible big company that has a lot of economical power, marketing power, and it's an IP very strong. I mean, it's like if you want to make movies, very good movies, and fighting with Disney, it's very difficult. And does not mean that Disney makes horrible movie because it's not like that. But at the same point, it's also very powerful, no? So I think it's the same. I think the good point would be not to erase the Golden Demon, but to try to say to the young people that they can open the eyes and see also something else. Because if you fix your mind with the idea that the best miniature in the world stay in the Golden Demon, you are blind of the 90% of the best things that stay outside. Not because of the fault of the Golden Demon in itself, but because outside there is all the freedom of the interpretation of the different style. So, I mean, I think the proper approach is always to be, you know, gray, not black or white, to try to to see everything. I mean,
yeah, it was a different experience for me. I had never last year was my first Golden Demon, and so it was an interesting to see how different, because I'd been to ReaperCon and Nova Open, and those are open style painting contests. So to go to something that was so focused on one brand within a range of style, it was an interesting aspect. And I think one of the things that you touched on is really interesting is now how the fantasy in things like, you know, in historical shows in Europe, you know, there's more of it now, and it's becoming, you know, 50-50. We're kind of experiencing that too in the US, because I think all of our historical groups are realizing they're old and dying out. And so if they don't expand to things like fantasy, and like you'll see it, I'm sure you have the IPMS in Italy too, right? The International Plastic Modelers Society. Here, sure. They've opened to Gundams, they've opened to fan, you know what I'm saying? And they realize that if they don't allow those things, they're going to die out. Those groups are just going to, literally. Because in the U.S., really, you got to be over the age of 55 to paint historicals. You know,
I think that if you want to talk about the story of historical and fantasy, what's happened, et cetera, we probably need one podcast just for that, divided in 30 different seasons. I was there from the beginning. I fight all my life against that, because creating Monte San Savino was that the point. When me and Luca Baldino, we join with the idea to make something different with Monte San Savino, that was the point. I mean, some of the people that lives now, that when you arrive now into the world of figure, you see a different world than was in like 20 years ago or 15 years ago. It was completely different. We were completely separated. I mean, you have the fantasist and you have the historical, and there were no connection between them. And in particular, the historical looks at us like if we are young guys with brushes that joy with puppets, with green orcs, okay? The monster. We paint puppets, they paint art. That was at that point. And in the other hands, we look at them like if they are gods, because the best painters in the world were the historicals. So we wanted to become like them, and they don't wanted us at all. So... So it was very fun. It was like a little bird that see his mom for the first time and try to go to the mom. No, mom, mom, and but the mom is not a chicken. So I don't know. It was and the funny things is that now we are in a situation that is basically the contrary. Because now fantasy painting is more evoluted, I think, than the historical one. I mean, there are still great historical painters. I mean, there is not in this moment a really new wave of historical painters. The new wave of historical painting that we see are by fantasy painters. I mean... Like the box arts by Mark Masclans of Fair Miniatures. Fantastic, incredible new wave of historical painting, but Mark is not an historical painter. I mean, he is a fantasy painter that paint also realistic and historical figure. So Kirill Kanaev, the best historical painter in the world, but Kirill Kanaev was known as Yellow One for 20 years, and he started and was one of the best painter in fantasy too in the past, and probably is the best also now. So that's the point. So you have still some of the great masters, but in this moment it's more difficult for the historical to reach the same power. And so now the situation starts to be a little bit different. So I started to see some of the fantasy world that don't want the historical, and I am very angry for that, because I don't fight for that. I didn't fight for 10 years for that. I don't wanted to erase them. I wanted to stay together. I mean, not to erase the other. So it's a very long and complex story.
Well, see, and it's interesting too, because I like, this is one of the reasons why Monty fascinates me. Because, you know, you go 2 years ago and the best in show is The Blaine Redfoot by Eric. And then last year it's... The Escape of Henry from Danilo. And so you go from a complete fantasy piece based off of a war game to a historical piece that wins best in show next year. And I just thought that was fantastic. You know what I mean? I thought that was like, that shows that everybody's welcome. Bring your A game, come sit, have a lot of food and look at beautiful art, whether it's fantasy.
It is always a battle to have that, okay? You have always to fight against people that don't want to make the peace happen, okay? And during this period, it's a sentence that means a lot, even out of our world, I mean. So the question is that I always fight for that, and there are a lot of people that do the same. I mean, when I meet people in Monte or in Scale Model Challenge, or even in Adepticon, Adepticon is really dedicated to gaming, But still, the sensation when I had classes or talking with the people is that at least the American community, it's open to see different things and style. I don't feel a closing mind about different idea of painting. I mean, they are passionate of wargaming, but they are open to see everything. So,
right. And I think the art side, you know, like we always talk about, we're kind of, I don't want to say we're in our infancy, but we're certainly just past toddlerhood here as far as the kind of taking a lot of it to the next level. You're seeing a lot more. And every time we don't have as many professional, maybe stay at home, like all they do is paint miniatures for a living necessarily as Europe. And there's a host of a variety of reasons, but it's amazing to me to not only see that, but then also see how welcoming the European community is to those American painters. You know what I mean? Like it's, I love seeing it. I love seeing how, you know, when Americans now go over to Europe in those competitions, they feel very welcome and they love all the people that they meet and such. That's why Monty is on my bucket list. I got to get there in the next couple of years.
Yeah, sure you are. Yeah, but to be sincere, US is very welcoming too. I always feel very welcome in US, always.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think that divide has narrowed a lot in the last few years, particularly. We hear over in the US, we hear a lot more about Monte. We hear a lot more about World Model Expo. And again, I think in Europe, there's growing awareness of the best that the US has to offer as well, which I'm not sure was really something that Europe was paying much attention to, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, and is starting to see stuff with the likes of, you know, Eric Swenson, notably Will Hahn, as they kind of are able to get over there and do the rounds in
Europe. And then Steven Garcia too, who's travels all over the place too. Yeah.
Now some of American in the last 5 or 6 years, I mean, I don't count the COVID period because it's like if it doesn't exist, but in the last five, six edition of Monte or Scale Model Challenge, the biggest contest in Europe, I see more and more American moving. Yeah. And not only professional, I mean, also passionate, because for example, Eric is a professional, but Steven, no, he has another job. So, but he is moving. So, and he's a great artist. So, and it's also funny because, you know, it seems that we are the European that bring, that take the art of miniature and bring this to US. But the real thing is that the art of miniatures born in US. So it's funny that, because in real, the first big artists that really created the new idea of miniatures like art were people like Shepard Payne, Bill Oran, and all this group. So it comes from US. I mean, the most old contest in the world of figure are from US. I think that Valley Forge, the MFCA, it's around 80 edition or something like that. 80. Mm-hmm. It's really out of this world. I mean, so the funny thing is that something happened. It will be very good to maybe at some point tell the story of what's happened, the movement of the story of the modeling, because you have the historical modeling that burns there. Then the European became better than the Americans and they grew much more. And then at some point there was something that happened. There was a kind of crack. And now we are in the situation that the US waiting from the European comes to teach how to paint. And it's funny if you think that you were the place where this kind of art's really born as we know that. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's funny. I'm a member of a group called the National Capital Model Soldier Society, and we just had our 66th annual show, and the group has been around for over 70 years. And yes.
But you know, there are different periods, no? So the 80s, the 90s, the 2000, 2010.
Right, and everything in the 70s was painted in disco colors, and then, you know. No.
Exactly like now. You see the circle that come back? You see now, if you open Instagram, all the miniatures are painted with a flashing purple light from here, then a flashing green light from here, then we put a yellow one from here, and okay, let's go. So at the end, things return. You know the story. The story is always out of the door. You just have to open.
Nice. Well, we should dig into Chimera, Dev. Why don't you get us there?
Yeah. So what was your inspiration to kind of get going with Chimera Colors and Chimera as a company?
Okay, Chimera born from, you know, it's basically it's the fantasy section of Pegaso Models, okay? Yeah. Pegaso Models is one of the most famous and important brand of miniature of the world. I think I can say that with no problem because it is like this. It's 30 years, no? That Pegaso is, and it was for 30 years at the top, okay? At some point, the Pegaso decided to don't just do some spotting fantasy figure, because in the past, some of the fantasy figures were made by Pegaso, but they decided that they wanted to create something really dedicated, so create a new brand that obviously it was Chimera because of the connection, mythological connection between Pegaso and Chimera. And it started from them, and they called me because they wanted someone to help with the art direction of the fantasy figure, someone that was well known in the community, that knows the text connection. I was the organizer of Monte San Savino, one of the three organizer of Monte San Savino, and so they thought that I can be the proper person to do that. I was very glad, obviously, for that. We started to talk about the ideas, and from this moment, I basically start to work for Chimera. This happened 7 years ago, I think, something like that. Always because there is this COVID 2 years that destroy our way of counting time, but it should be 7 years at this point. And when we started, there were not colors, okay? So at the beginning was only miniatures. But I remember that Pietro Balloni, one of the owner of Pegaso, told me that we maybe can have an opportunity and if I wanted to work on that. He say we have the opportunity to have a connection with a person that is a modeler, so he's passionate in modeling, and he has a company of color since 100 years. So a company that makes acrylics for 100 years. So maybe, no? I say, well, maybe yes. So we started to talk with that person, that is Alessandro Camarini, and he is an incredible chemical addicted guy. So he basically is able to do whatever I asked him. I ask something and he say, well, I don't know if it's possible, but then he do that. So it's incredible, really. And when we started, my idea was to try to go a little bit into the, you know, to reduce the painting to the minimum terms. That's my point. If you had a class with me, so you know that I do like that, no? I started really with the primary things and I tried to put every little things to arrive to the final recipe, no? So in my opinion, if you want to paint very well, and the same things is if you want to cook very well or if you want to play music very well, you have to know how the different notes or the different ingredients works. And much more you are close to use poor ingredients, much more you can do incredible things. But at the same time, it becomes more difficult. So the idea is I don't want to create another brand of colors similar to the others. And not because the others are bad, but because the others exist. I mean, we have a lot of acrylic colors in the world, and I would be very stupid if I say you that they are bad colors. They are not bad colors at all. Reaper colors are very good. I tested the new AK third generation. They are good. I mean, there are a lot of good painting in the world, a lot of good colors. But what was new in our intention, in my idea at the beginning, was to start with the poorness of the color. So I don't want to give to the artist a ton. I mean, that blue, the enchanted blue, memory of the past, enchanted blue. Right. I don't give it to you, the enchanted blue, but I give it to you, the apothem of blue. I mean, the powerful and best pigments blue that I can find in the market. That is just that. There is nothing more than that. And you create the enchanted blue, mixing this blue with other colors, in particular, mixing the white and the black inside the colors. I don't know if you know that, but most of the colors are equilibrated with the white inside. When you buy a colors, normally there is a lot of white inside. Yeah. There is nothing bad about that. I mean, it's normal. It's exactly how it is, because white helps, in particular, the titanium white helps to stabilize the colors, to make it this more coverage, etc., yeah, etc. So, and also for the matteness, they are good. It's good, etc., etc. But if you remember my class, you know what's happened when you mix white and black. No? Yeah. If you mix, yep, white and black, you have gray. So sometimes people, for example, that use a blue from, I don't know, whatever brand that you have in mind, a good blue maybe, and they say, yes, but if I add the black, it becomes, the color at the end becomes grayish. Or, for example, starting with a dark blue, very deep and beautiful dark blue, they put the white and looks gray. Yes, because in the mix there is white, probably, or black. No? So, and there is no possibility to conserve the saturation of the color if you have the white of the black inside. So my idea was, okay, let's try to take off everything from the colors and just to have the main ingredients. Try to select the best pigments on the market. And in this case, Alessandro was fantastic because 100 years of experience helps a lot to choose the best possible ingredients. And from that, we started to develop the colors. The idea was to try to have them as matte as possible, because most of the artistic approach on miniature wants to start with matte colors. So not shiny, but matte. So we try to do as much as we can, and we develop the forms, the how he's doing the colors during the years, to try to do always best the recipe. I mean, how is the resin, how is the acrylic that we use, etc., etc. But the real point is to still conserve a color that are very direct, flat. There is nothing inside, basically, only a lot of pigments and the acrylic resin, and that's it. That's the idea. The problem is that obviously you have to know how to use them. But the good point, and is what I always suggest to the people that for the first time buy Chimera Colors, is to try to introduce them into the flow that they normally use. Because if you try to use them all alone at the beginning and you never use a pure pigment color, you probably will be very shocked. It's difficult to control at the beginning. So the idea is try to, at the beginning, introduce the color inside your normal flow. You do your blue. You love to use this blue from this brand. Okay, so you start like this. And then you take one of our blue and you put it into the mixing and you start to see what's happened. So the idea is that if you use them a lot and a lot and a lot, at some point, it will become very natural to use them much more. That's the point, because it becomes like a natural thing to take a pure pigment. Don't mean that you have not to use pre-mixed colors. We created that too. In our range, there are pre-mixed colors. The only difference is that I wanted that the pre-mixed color were made by artists, for artists. So in our range, all the colors that are pre-mixed by an artist. So we have set from some of the most important artists in the world, and we will have more in the future. So like Mark Masklands, like Michael Pisaski, Danilo Cartacci, Fabrizio Russo, Massimiliano Ricchiero. We have a color from Eric, for example. So
yep, he's got a color.
Yeah. So that's the idea. So the idea is to have in one side these very professional colors. We have two set of pure pigments. They are 13 and 14 colors. Pigments in the two set, where you can basically have different kind of stuff, because the first set is dedicated to you should have all the colors that you need for do everything. So the idea is that it's like a starting toolbox for all. You can do all with that. But if you start to love the pure pigment, you also start to understand that different pigments has different effect that is not possible to obtain with mixing. So it's interesting also to have some very particular kind of pigments. For example, in the second set, we have a pigment that is the alizarin crimson, that is a pure alizarin crimson color, and it's a transparent pigment, but it's very difficult to have this stone mixing other colors. It's very difficult. So it's useful to have it and to use it. Okay, I can continue for hours, but I think you get the point. I just add one thing, sir, that we have, there will be a news. Very quick, we are close to have a new about the colors. So we are creating something new and you will see. Stay tuned.
You know, and it's interesting that you talked about it because the first time I'd ever used Chimera colors was in your class. And I struggled a little bit when I first started mixing in, starting to use the white, and I was kind of like, this is not reacting the way my model paint head is expecting to react. You know what I mean? Like, and so it was an interesting experiment. And there's a local store by me that every so often they have the full set. And I went in the other day I was like, you know what? I'm going to Adepticon. I'm gonna go ahead and bite the bullet and buy the set, but they didn't have it anymore. Like, damn it! And so, but yes. I'll get there. I'll get to Chimera colors more. I have two. I have Eric's color and I have the orange. And so,
yeah, I came at it from a slightly different angle because I learned a lot from Matt DiPietro and I love using heavy body acrylics, but of course with heavy body acrylics you can get into that lazy shortcut of offsetting the lack of coverage with a lot of these paints by just slapping it on thicker, which is terrible, right? Like, it's a really bad habit. Yeah, there we go. It's a really bad habit to get into because you're just like shortcut your way through it. You're still using pure pigments, but that you can slap it on so thick that you then start losing what's underneath with the model just because you're being lazy. So I think the thing that Chimera really offers is that smoothness of application, which heavy bodies doesn't have, while still retaining those kind of pure artistic abilities with pure pigments, single pigments. You know how they're going to behave when they're mixed together. It's not model paints where there's white in, or you know, your brown, your yellow brown actually has green pigment in it and you weren't expecting that, and all of a sudden you've kind of run into gray because you were mixing.
Yeah, that's, but in real, obviously, I didn't invent the poor pigment color. I mean, in art, it's normal to use poor pigment color. Most of the oil brand are made with poor pigments. It's something that is not used for modeling. And because the color, we will talking about that also later, because I'm sure that you asked me something about the brushes. So we're also talking about that for the brushes. But the point is, that at the end, the point is not to have something that is good or not. The point is to have something that is good for the purpose that you need. I mean, some of the, Liquitex made, Liquitex and Golden probably made the best acrylic in the world. I mean, so you can say, okay, I just buy Liquitex and Golden and I have the best because they made probably the best acrylic in the world. There is no big discussion about that. The question is that Liquitex and Golden have no interest in the purpose of painting figure. They don't care about that. They care about all other things. I mean, for them, doing colors means doing color for artists that paint a wall, that paint a canvas or whatever. They are not interested in that kind of things. They don't create that. So what basically I did is to try to take the philosophy of the art brand and try to make this color more close to the purpose of painting miniatures. So a lot of coverage, a lot of pigments, matteness, because normally the artistic color are very glossy. This is because normal artists, fine artists, they don't want matte colors. They even, at the end of the work, they even add like a coat of super shiny things over the panel or the canvas, because they don't need, they at the end they equalize the canvas. We don't need to equalize the canvas. We love to have, I don't know, something like a gem that is shiny, something that is matte, like the clothes or something like that. So we love to change the the surface of the things, and in particular with something that is very little. If you make something very little super shiny, it becomes like a candy, no?
Yeah. Right.
You know what it reminded me of, using the Chimera colors? I don't know. Have you ever tried the acrylic gouache paints? Like Liquitex makes a line of acrylic gouache.
Yeah, sure. The inks.
Well, no, they're not. They're actually they're thicker. It's a liquidy thick, like I don't know how to explain it.
No, I understand. Yes, okay.
But it reminded relatively similar in the how they feel, because I when I buy paints, I put them on my palette, I play with them, then I actually will touch them with my fingers to see what their texture is and stuff along, you know. I like to play with paint.
Yeah, they are close. I mean, to be sincere, Chimera are more close to watercolors.
Fair enough. Yeah.
In fact, some artists in Italy, they started to use our colors instead of watercolors, and with the same kind of technique, because they have the good things of the watercolor in terms of coloring, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, you have the fact that acrylics fix, no? Watercolor doesn't fix. If you put the water over a watercolor, you have to fix this at the end. The good point of the acrylics is that it fixes, no?
Yeah.
So they are more close to watercolor in some way. Mm-hmm.
So Deb, can we talk a little bit about the Kickstarter that they're delivering?
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about Tenebrae and
Tenebrae the 1, idea Tenebrae behind 2 it? Or both?
Both. Well, let's do both. Yeah.
What is the question? Is in general, I mean?
So where did the idea come from? And I'm also kind of curious as how you bring in sculptors. I know Africa was a part of them, and such, that she was on the show previously. But I'm curious as to how you from concept to getting sculptors in would be cool.
So about the Kickstarter of Tenebrae. This was our second Kickstarter. I mean, the first Tenebrae was the second Kickstarter by Chimera. The first one was made with Aradia models, and was made the year before, Ultima Thule. It was a very good experience for us. It was good because we started with something that was very big, but at the same time was split between two companies, so it was much more easy to control. And it was our first approach with a Kickstarter. It's something very complex. And I know that you will have Ricardo here in the future, in a future podcast, so you can talk with him, because he is the very nerd about Kickstarter stuff. He knows everything. He's much better than me to tell you how the things works, etc., etc. So the first Tenebrae borns from an idea of Ricardo, because Ricardo and the main owner of Pegaso, Luca Marchetti, that is the main art director, the super big boss of Pegaso Model, they had an idea for creating a figure that was Kalia, I mean, the necromancer with the whole diorama of the first Kickstarter. And it, at the beginning, was an idea of a figure, not to do a Kickstarter, but just of a figure, okay? Then the figure became so big and so interesting, then we decided together to make a Kickstarter around this, with this idea to this very dark gothic fantasy in this environment that was very dark and creepy. People loves things like that. That's the point. I mean, people loves vampire, loves undead, loves at least this is what we supposed. Ricardo in particular, he say, probably this is a good point. And it was a good point, I think, because the Kickstarter works very well, the first and the second one too. Because you asked me about the sculpting process, the sculpting process of the Kickstarter is not different from the other sculpting process. I mean, we have some sculptors that are basically inside Chimera. For example, Africa, it's a sculptor of Chimera. It's an inside person in Chimera. But also the other most important sculptor from Chimera is Alberto Acquaviva. And Alberto is not exactly inside the Chimera in terms of legal. I mean, he's a freelance, but in real, he basically sculpted 99% for us. So he's basically the main sculptor of Chimera. So the first two obviously are selected from this, no? You mean the people that you work with every day, et cetera, because you are connected with and they are very good. So that's the point. And then you move into other artists that are artists that is some of the artists that we work usually, okay? Because imagine that in the production of Chimera, you have some of artists that are like, you have always them. I mean, Africa, Alberto. Then you have some others that you collaborated sometimes during the year. For example, now a new collaborator that we started to work with in the last year, it's Eduardo Velayos. He's a fantastic sculptor, incredible sculptor that is very good to do both fantasy and historical. And we started to work with him for historical figure. He also made the 30th anniversary knights from Pegasus model. I don't know if you saw this, yes. But it's a fantastic figure.
Gorgeous.
Yeah. And for example, now I am just finished painting the box art of the Teutonic Grandmaster Boost that is made by him. It's fantastic. And now, for example, he is sculpting for us a fantasy figure. Okay. So basically it's that. For example, we collaborated not always, not every month, but all the years we have three or four figures from Joaquin Palacios, or we collaborate with different artists. And when you do a Kickstarter, you have to plan this a lot of time before. So you just, I don't know how to say, you schedule your artist to make this possible. And if the question is, if it is easy, it's not easy at all. We arrived to the first Kickstarter and to the second in particular, very close to the burnout. Very, very close. We, at the end, at least me and Ricardo, we were dead.
I got to tell you, I just got my Galen sculpt from the second and it's gorgeous. Like, I honestly, it's one of the... I even was just kind of like, you know, I was sitting there looking at it. And a lot of times when I pick up something and if I see a mold line, I just grab a knife and work on it anyways. Just even if I'm not going to prep it, it's just so I don't miss it later. The only thing I had to remove on the model were the casting connections. I didn't have a single mold line on the model. I was like, this is gorgeous. You know, I wish I had the funding at the time to go get more. I only got the 75mm Galen, but I was just like, yeah, this is, because that ticked off all my boxes, a knight, so, you know, the sword option, and, you know, like, and I love the work that Eric, because I think Eric painted the box art for that, and I love what he did with the purple and the shadows and everything and stuff.
Yeah,
and
so that was kind fantastic, of fantastic version.
Yeah, and so but the combination of the sculpt and the paint job on it, and I'm, you know, I've moved mostly away from.
For us, one of the most beautiful things to do this Kickstarter is the beautiful connection that we have as team. I mean, sometimes it's very difficult because when you work together, sometimes you also are very stressed. So sometimes it's difficult because everyone expected a lot from the others. So it's very, stressing. But at the same time, it's good the way we work as team. Because, for example, all the pieces from this Kickstarter are made by different for example, in the new Kickstarter, there is one side of the figure that were created by the idea of Luca Marchetti, our boss, I mean, and another part were created by us, I mean, by the team, me, Africa, and Ricardo, and it was a very good way of working because the concept was made by me. I mean, I made this in Photoshop, but it was like a continuous, this is the idea. And then Ricardo say, Emma, maybe more like this. No, maybe not like this. Maybe not like that. And it was, sometimes it's challenging because, for example, no, if I'm doing, for example, Galen. Galen, it's a concept it's my concept, okay? So I created this in Photoshop. But when you create something like that and you have an idea, no? You go with the idea, so you show the idea and you say, wow, I am very convinced about that. And in the other side, you have someone that say to you, yeah, but this don't work. No, 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 it works very well. It's fantastic. But at the end, it was right. I mean, at the end, it was right. It doesn't work, so I have to change things. And if you believe in the in your colleague, I mean, this helps you to take every kind of criticism in the proper way. I mean, you take this as a way that someone that loves you say to you to make better.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's clear in English what I said.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it's an interesting point because, you know, we've talked with artists in the past and with sculptors about that tension between over sculpting and having space for the art, for the painter to express on the model, right? But I mean, for a lot of the Chimera, and I'm assuming for the Pegaso figures as well, you've got a prior stage, right? You've got the concept art. The sculpture is not coming solely from the sculptor. There's a concept that is provided for the sculptor to work off. So I'm assuming there must be conflicts of that nature between the concept art and the sculpt that is created, and where do those tensions tend to be? Where's the balance that you're finding there?
It's always difficult because in this case, for example, I was the concept artist of that figure or other figure, but sometimes you have art concept artists that it's external, no? For example, in the first Tenebrae, the concept art of, for example, Obitus and Asteria, that are the two main character. I mean, Asteria is the paladin, the girl paladin, no? This born in the same way than Galen. I mean, I was the one that makes the first concept, the first bashing concept. But then we decided to make this redrawed by a real drawer, because I am not a real drawer. I worked like in a rough way. And at that time I was less good than now. So the idea was, okay, the concept is good, but we need that someone redesign that. So you have another filter. I mean, you have the idea, the first concepting, then the concept by the artist that maybe is different than yours, but maybe he is right. So it's always like this. It's always a kind of fighting. But the important thing is to be convinced, I mean, to have faith in your colleague. If you have the faith that the people that talk to you is trying to do the best things possible and it's not about fighting each other, at the end, you arrive to the point, for me, in the proper way. And I think the best figure that we had in this Kickstarter, I mean, the ones that I think they exit in the best way, they coming from this kind of connection and also fighting discussion to arrive to the end.
Amazing.
It's awesome. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I think too, that I've kind of, you're in a different spot than like somebody who's like a Titan Forge or something along those lines that solely focuses on selling STL files. Right. And their STL files, they've got to over detail them to make them attractive to both the people that want to play with them. And then that whole other 3D printing hobby. And so I feel like I'm like moving back into the world of the cast resin, because there's more a room to be an artist on them, you know, like there's more open space, there's more canvas, and that's one of the things I love about the Galen model, is that there's a lot of little areas where you can have some fun with it and just not worry. Like, there's no emblem on the shield. That's an awesome opportunity for some freehand. You know what I mean? And it's some time to play.
You know, the idea, it should be, I mean, not always you strike the goal. Sometimes you also make mistakes. It's a part of the work. I mean, you try different things. Sometimes it's okay. Sometimes it's happened that something simply does not work because you try different things. But the point, it should be then a company like Chimera or company like us, like I can quote a lot of other companies like Big Child or Scale 75 or whatever. I mean, company that works for modelers, they should work with the idea of the final purchasing. I mean, the final client, it's a painter. So you should try to think about that. Sometimes you are able to do, sometimes not. But that's the difference between the STL. I mean, I think the discussion about the STL is very complex because STL, it could be our death in the future, probably. But I don't know. The problem is that I just can do this little provocation, okay? What's happened when, not in years, but tomorrow, because it will happen tomorrow, okay? When you even don't need someone that stole, a 3D figure from an IP, like, I don't know, stealing from a video game, and then with ZBrush retouching to create an STL and print it, and you can paint your fantastic World of Warcraft not original and pirate figure, no? Okay, this is what's happened now. But what's happened when you even don't need someone to do that? You just go into the new Midjourney version, 3D Midjourney version. You type, I want a barbarian with an axe that looks like blah, 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 blah. And you have the STL ready to be printed in your house.
Yeah.
And it's not happening in years. It's happening tomorrow, probably.
Yeah.
That's the point. Yeah. So at this point, the only difference between that and the other kind of figure, it's the professionality I wanted to imagine of the producer that creating things for the purposing of the modeling, because they know, they have the story, they have the experience. So what is the difference between me and a sentence on a new EA? I don't know. It's a very difficult answer. I mean, it's not an easy question. I wanted to say that the difference is that probably there is the experience of years of things that I don't know, but I sincerely don't know if we will survive to that. I mean, as a painter, yes. As a producer, I have no idea. We have to see. Maybe we will do like the, like vinyl. Who of us can imagine in 2001 that at some point the vinyl disc come back again? No one, come on. In 2001, we imagined that was like just something from the past. And now they start to print them again because there is like a market for that. Probably could happen also something like this. I don't know.
And I think that that goes back to the concept, of introduced scarcity potentially in the models with more use of, limited print runs, signed kind of numbered prints. And yes. And moving it away from technology to preserve that kind of
or maybe value. my opinion is that at some point probably we have to come back to the analogic sculpting, because at some point the analogic, I mean, no EA can do Patrick Masson, because Patrick Masson makes this with his hand.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's like to say that saying like this seems that I say that a 3D artist is not a real artist, and it's not like this. I mean, for me, it has the same dignity. But question is that it's much more easy for an AI to copy the digital art. I mean, than
absolutely.
Because the media is the same. I mean, the medium. So that's the point.
So when I was hanging out with you at LVO just a few weeks ago, you were clearly very, very proud of your brushes, and I had a wonderful time trying them out. They definitely take a lot of inspiration from the more traditional art world in terms of the variety of form and the shaping of them. How did you kind of get to the point where you wanted to design your brushes and the brushes came out the way that you wanted? What were the considerations in that?
Okay, so yes, I am super proud about the brush. Super proud, because I think that at least at this point, I think that they are a product with not weak points. I am very sure about that because I tested them a lot, and I am sure about that. Okay, just coming back to the beginning. The idea is, okay, we have to create our brushes, but the first things that I didn't want, we didn't want, is to just go to a producer, okay, checking the catalog and say, okay, this brush, we put Chimera, and then we put in the market. I don't want that. I want to create something custom. So our producer helps us with that. So we didn't take from the catalog of the producer the brushes, but we started from their catalogs and started from some of our idea. In particular, I really designed for the producer some tips. Say we want something like that and something like that with the millimeter and the thickness and the longness. So and the producer was super good. He was super prepared, and he said yes to everything. He said we try, we can do everything. And starting from that, we start to test. You can't imagine how many glasses of brush. Now it's a podcast, so they can't see the video, but you can see that these are just two of the probably 20 glass of on. Brushes that
keep, I hold it, hold those up. I'm gonna take a picture of it. Yeah, hold up those, and this is, I could take a picture of the screen and use it to promote it. Perfect.
So I had a lot of, here there are like a thousand of different brands, because we tested a lot of stuff. And then at this point, it happens two important things. The first things was for me, I want to create the perfect main brush. That was my first goal. We at least need the first important brush. And the idea is normally will be like the one, okay? So I started with that idea. I want to create the perfect one. So working on thickness and longness and the proportion and things. And at this point, I started to notice one thing, but during the preparation, I started to try to understand, analyzing the brushes, what I want and why I want that. And the first things that I pointed is, all the brushes that we use in modeling are not made for modeling, at least the 99%, okay? The only brushes that are made for modeling are brushes for, rookie brushes. I mean, like synthetic brush for modeling, they are not artist brush, okay? The artist brush that we normally use and that are considering the best for our work are brush made basically for watercolorists, for illustrators, okay? So, for example, the Winsor & Newton Series 7, that is the brush. I mean, it's the apothegm of the perfect brush, no? The finest sable Series 7. For years, we always buy that because it was the best brush in the world, and we always want that. It was a brush created for illustrators and for watercolorists. That means that we are not in a video now, so it's difficult to try to explain that. But I try to say that the shape of the brushes for watercolor, it's a kind of vessel. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's like this, okay? Then maybe you can help me with the language, okay? It's like this. So basically starts with close to the metal part. You have a part that is less thick, then it becomes more thick into the body, and then goes into the point, okay? In this way, you have the first part that is less thick, that doing like this, okay? I don't know how to say that, but that moves close, to the ferrule. Bend close to the...
there's a point of weakness at the ferrule, so that's the main point of flex for the brush.
And this is not a bad thing of the brush. It was how the brush should work to work with watercolors. I mean, it's not because the brush is not well made, it's perfectly made like this, but it's not good for us because we don't paint on paper. We don't want that the brush bends so much. We would love that the brush stay as stiff as possible. So we basically do that. So the idea is to try to make the shape as much as possible triangular, conic. Okay, I don't know if it's clear what I mean. Conic. So you still have the body to have water on it, but you have the most powerful part of the brush that is close to the metal. So that means that in that way, the bending is more concentrating into the point, okay? Mm-hmm. And the point is more stiff and more pointy, more sharp, okay? Starting from this idea, when I have, when I starting with this point, I discovered that in the catalog of this producer, there were some brushes created for other purpose, okay? And some of them has this strange triangular shape, okay? That it's a kind of shape, the petal shape, that is normal in art. I mean, you can see it a lot in art stuff or in cosmetic or in something like that. But they are short. So I see this shape that it was triangular and short, and I ask to myself, what's can happen if we make something with this shape but long? I mean, maybe it does not work, but we will see. And it works. It works very well, because in that way you have a brush that has a lot of space for water. The point of strongness is much more on the base, because now the base became flat and big. And at the same point, you have like if all the bristles were pressed into the tip, okay? So in that way, you have the tip that is very stiff, but at the same time, you have a brush that with your pressure can be open and becomes like a very long, flat brush. And this start, for me, was like super shocking when I tried this, and I decided to explore this and to try different also sides. So for the first set that we have now, we decided to mix two of this triangular shape, that is the number two and the number zero, okay? That is is the size of the point, not the size of the brush, because the two, in real, if you see the two, looks like a four, probably for a round brush, but the point is very, very thin. If you remember, it's very, very, very thin, the point. And then we also add the one round, because the idea is that you still have to use a round brush, because a round brush is perfect for some things. And then we added also two super small brushes for the very little details. To be sincere, professional brushes normally don't use a lot triple zero, normally. For example, I quite never use that. I normally arrive until the double zero for some freehand little stuff or something like that. But to be sincere, I paint most of the things with the two, the one, and the zero. I mean, but since we the world of figure is very big, and there are a lot of people that also paint very little 28 millimeter figure for wargaming, so you also need a very good super small brush for super small detail. And our two double zero and the triple zero, these two brushes are really like needle. They are super, super precise. For example, another interesting thing, no, is that a lot of the quality of the bristle, no, we used obviously Kolinsky, because Kolinsky is the best bristle in the world. To be sincere, now we are working also on something else, but you will see in the close future, okay? But the Kolinsky is the best, the Sable is the best kind of four. But there are different kind of, no? For example, the first Kolinsky that the producer proposed to me, it was for him the best one. I mean, the one more prestigious. And for me, it was terrible, because it was very, very soft. And it was perfect for watercolor, because you have this brush that open and close very close, very, very quickly, very, very soft. But for the purposing of painting figure, it's not okay like this. You need some bristle more rigid. So he gives me another kind of sable, another, I think it's the same sable, just take the bristle from another part of the body. I don't know so much about this kind of details. But the difference is that in that case, the bristle was more rigid. And for me, it was much better for us. So it was a very long work. I worked a lot on that, but also the others, because at the end I was like, I try 30 brushes, then I go into five, then to Riccardo, now try also you, let me know. So it was a continuous discussion. But I really think that, it's very easy for someone to say my product is the best in the world, no? Okay, but I don't know if it's the best in the world, but it's a very fantastic product. I am sure that no one that received these brushes can say nothing bad about them. And to be sure about that, we also asked for an extra quality check. They normally made two sides of quality check, the producer, like the first one, it's for the normal production, and the luxury production, they have like the second check. I asked to pay more to have the third check because I want a brush that is basically perfect. Then, I don't know if the people that listening knows that, but I wanted to say to the people, because it's very important, even the best brush in the world are made by hand. So something that is made by hand can also be failed for some reason. So there is always the possibility that a brush comes out fail. I don't know if the others do the same. What we do is that if the brush is fail, we send a substitution, I mean.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's interesting too, because like, I wonder where the brushes fall for y'all, because, you know, you have the Winsor Newton Series 7, then you throw in, like, if you take a one from a Winsor Newton and then take a one from, let's say, the Raphael 8404, they're different. Enormous. Like they're so different. Right. And you know, like the Raphael one looks like a Winsor Newton 3, you know, like how much the difference in it. So where do y'all kind of fall in between those sizes? Like, as far as like, let's say you're one,
I think it's always difficult because every different producer has a different way of nominating the numbers. Okay. So it's very, very, very difficult. So at the end, in my case, I just starting exactly from this idea of the one. And the idea is that this is the one that I imagine for modeling. So is the, that's the idea. Then probably our one, I don't have now here a Winsor Newton Series 7 to make the confrontation, but probably in terms of tips, okay? The tip is close to the one of Winsor & Newton. The shape, no. The tip, in terms of, of real, the tip, it's probably close. So that's the idea. Probably
I know that was a tough question. It's a tough question without having points of reference and differences. I
mean, the other consideration there is different manufacturers use different lengths of bristle. So, you know, are you talking about the tip? Are you talking about the length of bristle? Are you talking about the size of the belly of the brush? All of those things factor into it. And then when you get into the triangular tipped, the conical brushes that Francisco was just talking about, like they're a completely different shape, completely, completely different. They're quite wide at the base. They have that triangular tip, and the ferrule even is different because the ferrule is flattened, which holds the brush itself in a slightly different shape. And so not only is it a different shape that's not comparable, when you use it, there are different ways of using it. If you use it with kind of the flattened ferrule side on, you're going to get a broader stroke than if you use it with the narrow part of the ferrule side on, which will give you a much finer, straighter point. The bristles will hold together better because they're held that much more firmly. The sizing on brushes is only consistent within a particular line. Like even Rosemary & Co. Series 8s versus 33s, and I use both, but you know,
I got you hooked on the eights, huh?
Yeah, they have very different sizes.
I mean, I think it's not very, at the end, it's not very important the number. It's important when you paint how you feel. That's the point. For example, the triangular shape, I didn't say that during the podcast, but one of the funny things about this triangular shape is that when you paint with them, you don't feel uncomfortable. I mean, it's very easy to get into the use of the brush. It's not something that forces you to change your approach. You just start to turn the brush in your hand in a really natural way. And then if you understand that they can be, it can be turned to have different kind of shapes and things and brush strokes, then it becomes like a kind of game when you paint. So it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting and useful. And for example, the difference between the zero and the two, okay, the point of the zero, obviously, it's more thin than the two. But to be sincere, the two has a point that it's super thin too. So, I mean, you can basically do quite the same things with the two. The difference is that the zero has less bristle and it's shorter. So it becomes more close to something that you can use like a little flat brush too. So it's very good, for example, for smoothing, for... There are a lot of different approaching, or for example, if you have just to straight a very thin line or something like that, a round brush is still the best. I mean, it's normal, no? So right. I don't want it to erase the round brush from the world. The idea is to have also different shape, to have different approach. That's the point. And to be sincere, this long triangular shape, it's very good to me. It's super good.
That's awesome. And are you going to bring some to Adepticon with you?
Sorry, I lost.
Oh, will you be bringing any of them to Adepticon with you?
Yeah, sure. I don't have them to sell. I try to bring with me some set to let the people try for sure.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking. I brushes to me are. I love paintbrushes, and I love it's almost like an addiction. You know, I love trying different paintbrushes, and so I hope I get a chance to try them. And you know when the
thousand of brushes here, really, and also other boxes of brushes and brushes of all sizes. Really, I have more brushes than color now.
Nice. That's awesome. Oh man. Oh wait. Well, so we're past the hour mark, so we don't want to keep you too much longer because I know you got a lot going on.
I speak a lot. I am problematic.
No, you know what? They're not. People aren't listening to hear Deb and I talk. They're gonna sign in to hear you talk. So that's a good thing that you talk more than we do.
Yeah, but I talk too much. Maybe too much.
So the motto of the podcast is better, braver, happier painters. Is there a piece of advice that you could share with our listeners as they continue their journeys?
Yes. First of all, try to enjoy. Painting, it should be something enjoying. I mean, modeling, it should be something enjoying. For me, it's a work and it's still something that I enjoy to do. My work is not only paint now, but it's a lot about doing art direction, doing graphic stuff, doing other things. And I love also that things. But when I don't paint for a lot of time, maybe days because I have other things to do, I miss painting. Because for me, painting is still something relaxing, peaceful, and beautiful to do. So the first thing is to enjoy. But my biggest suggestion is to go outside and see the figure in real life. We are jailed inside these little things, the smartphone, and we are jailed in Instagram, jailed in YouTube, jailed in... That is fantastic. I mean, it's fantastic. But miniatures, it's something in 3D. It's something little and in 3D. It's something that you grab with your hand and you can turn in your hand. And the sensation that you have when you see something in real life, it's completely different. And helps also to see a lot of things that, for example, looks fantastic and then they are not so much. Or things that they look not very interesting and then you discover that they are fantastic. Because one of the things that I don't like of the last years is that a lot of the wave of painting figure became much more painting for picture than painting for real life. Right. It's not always like this. Obviously, there are some fantastic new artists that paint the picture are fantastic, and in real life, they are fantastic too. But there is a wave of that, a wave of, okay, I make the picture for Instagram, I have 1,000 likes, that's enough. But in real life, miniatures are something that you have to touch, to see, and to watch over. Because only in real life, you can see the scale, first of all, that is very important with a figure, and the grain of the brush strokes. One of the most important things when you paint, and the difference between a good painter and a master, is the grain of the brushstrokes, the way he cover or she cover the figure. Someone are very flat, someone are very deep and thick. Different interpretation, different styles, but the brushstrokes is the soul of the painter. And you can't catch this from a picture. There is no way. There is no way. The only way is to do a picture that is a bad picture, because show things in not a proper way. So only in real life you can feel that. So go outside and see other things painted by others.
It is a great line. The brushstroke is the soul of the painter. That is beautiful. That's a thing of beauty. I think I need to go get a tattoo with that on it. That's amazing. That's something to think about for sure. Francesco, do you want to share with our listeners where they can find your absolutely amazing artwork?
Well, there is my Instagram page, Francius Art, Francius with two U, no? the same name that you see in the... And you can always, obviously go to pegasoworld.com, that is the Pegaso and Chimera site, where there are a lot of my stuff, because I painted mostly figure from Pegaso and Chimera, because... for obvious reason, and also my Facebook page if you want. But I also suggested to follow the Chimera Models YouTube account, where we started to put a lot of video. In particular, Ricardo were more active than me, but I started also to put videos. I put 3 videos, and I will do it again in the future. So I think it's interesting. So,
and we'll put links to all of it in the show notes too, so people can just click right to okay. It. Dev, awesome. Any parting
thoughts from me? No, I'm just soaking it all in. I've really enjoyed this conversation. It's been fantastic.
You think this is good? Get him in real life in a classroom. You're going to have a damn good time to learn.
I'm looking forward to it. It's coming up in like a month's time. I'm very excited. So
see you soon.
Yep, and I'll have that caramel macchiato waiting for you, man.
Fantastic. We have it together, okay?
Yeah, perfect.
Thank you, Francesco, so much.
Thank you very much for listening to me, and sorry for the lot of words.
Thank you so much for listening.
A special shout out to our Patreons. Thank you very much for your support. And if all you others are inclined to do so, we'd love to have you as a Patreon also. Check out our link tree in the show notes for all our quick links.
Email us at listeningtopaintdry@gmail.com. Tell us what you're working on, or what cons you've been to, or how you're doing. We'd love to hear from you. Also, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube at listeningtopaintdry.
We're also on X at Dry Listening.
Like, subscribe, or follow us wherever you get your podcast. If you could also leave us a good review, we'd appreciate that.
We'll be back soon with another riveting episode of Listening to Paint Dry.
Listening to Paint Dry is a production of LTPTWMD. All rights reserved. No portion of this recording may be used without the express written consent of the host. The music is Death by a Thousand Questions by Springtide. Download from the free music archive on a non-commercial attribution share alike basis. All views and opinions expressed in the show are solely the views and opinions of the person who said them. All celebrity voices, if any, were impersonated and done so poorly.